From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello and welcome to episode 131 of the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. I am your host and Diz historian Michael Boulding, and I am joined by my co-host, producer, and good friend Craig Williams, who is the Diz's own 20th Century Fox. Craig, how are you today?
I'm freezing.
You are? Yeah. Why? What is it? Is it like 60 degrees there or something?
Oh, no. We, tonight, as of the night that we're recording this, I'm not going to date it too much with that, but it's a cold week the entire week here in Florida, for the most part. But tonight, it is, it's saying it's going to be a low of 35. So,
oh, wow. It's close. It's about where we're at out here, too. We have rain also.
Yeah, no, and that's it's kind of a chilly week. So yesterday wasn't that cold. The highest temperature we're going to see all this week is the day that the show's released. It's supposed to be 76, but lows every night in the 50s or 40s. And so I am super happy because, you know, after the holidays, always looking for ways to cut money. And if I don't have to turn on the AC, then I am a very happy guy.
No. So Craig, is Oscar weeping because the Walt Disney Company is wiping away decades of cinematic history by removing the Fox from 20th Century Fox and Fox Searchlight?
I don't understand this decision at all. I mean, I do understand it that, you know, not to get political or anything with it, but I would have to imagine that regardless of what would ever be put out in the media and what would be said about it, I have a good feeling that a lot of it has to deal with trying to take that studio away from what has become of the other side of Fox with Fox News and even breaking it off from Fox Broadcasting. Not that, you know, there's anything wrong with either sector of it, Fox News or Fox Broadcasting, but it's definitely on the movie side of it, which is something they're very proud of. I can understand why they would want to pull it off and rebrand it as its own situation. But I mean, Fox's history, there's 100 years of history in that studio, and to just strip its name away is not, it does not sit well with me at all. And I talked about it on one of the shows.
Terrible.
This week. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, I think it's terrible. I agree with you. I could see going forward because it seems like they sort of abandoned a lot of the shows that, or films that were in the pipeline. 20th mm-hmm. Century Fox didn't really promote them, and like they wanted to be done with them, sort of like the Star Wars trilogy. And then I could see moving forward with anything new coming out of those studios, okay, fine, because now it's the Disney, you know, version. But I think to, you know, leave what's already there alone. Because you're right. In the film industry, the, you know, 20th Century Fox was a juggernaut.
Yeah, it's not. People aren't showing up because it's 20th Century. They're showing up for the Fox. It's not, you didn't go to the movies to see a Searchlight movie. You saw a Fox Searchlight movie. It's, the name is important. Like, it's, like, the frustrating part of it is, take it as if Disney was Fox in this realm, and Disney sold their company to Fox. And to turn around and say, Walt Disney Studios, we're gonna take that and rename it our, you know, mystical studio or something. Like, I don't even know how to go with that.
Or if
that
they
realm.
Just
like,
put their own logo on it.
Yeah,
and it's called like everything 20th Century Fox.
Yeah, it's like that would be taken as sacrilege. And so to turn around and have that same kind of disrespect towards this company that they bought. It just, it really doesn't sit well with me. And as long I'm okay with it, I guess, in the long run, because I'm going to have to be okay with it. It's nothing's going to change moving forward. But so help me, if they go back to all the old movies, the classic movies, and they change that fanfare, and it starts popping up as 20th Century Studios in front of Star Wars or Sound of Music or any other classic Fox film, I will probably rip my hair out and go bald.
I think that's what people are afraid of, that, you know. And I don't know. It's, and you know, how many people really associated 20th Century Fox with Rupert Murdoch and, you know, yeah, the news division? I think very few people did, if any.
Yeah, so. I didn't personally.
I never did.
Yeah, we're also, you and I are on a different level, and I would imagine that a lot of our audience is, so I hope I'm not offending anyone out there, but I think a lot of the people who do listen to us are they have an interest in these fields, so they understand the division, and they know the difference and know that a company can be very diverse in terms of the different sectors of it. And that's how Fox was run. And, you know, when Disney bought what it bought, it didn't buy everything. It didn't buy the entirety of Fox. There was stuff left off the table. And it was primarily what they were going after was especially the movie and TV division, which they were successful at getting. But that left the other stuff, the news and sports. And I know I'm kind of stumbling on my words over this, but I've had to think a lot about it today, because we talked about it earlier in a different recording today, and it's just one of those moves that the second I read it and reacted to it, it made me feel bad, because personally, of the opening intros and stuff for movies, I think there's no bigger ones, in my opinion, from how I grew up, than 20th Century Fox in that fanfare. Like,
oh, I agree.
And I love them all. I love the Roar of the Lion on MGM. I love the Globe of Universal. And I love Disney's. There are so many epic ones out there. Paramount's is amazing too, with the Mountain. But something about the drums and the orchestra with 20th Century Fox is just like, it takes me back to the very first time I saw Star Wars when I was a kid and heard it, or all the times that I'd be at my grandparents' house and they'd be watching Sound of Music, and like, it all comes together like that. So it almost feels like it's a personal assault against me.
Well, I vote for rebranding it 20th Century Mouse and Mouse Searchlight. Oh, let's just go full circle here.
Why are you doing that to me, Michael? We don't need that either. But I mean, you do bring up a good point, though. It could be worse.
Yes. I can always find a way it could be worse. Let's hope they don't go back and change history by rebranding, which I think is what everyone's worried about, and just deal with it going forward.
Yeah, I have a feeling they won't, considering the fact that, like, you know, they reinstated the fanfare into Star Wars movies and such that had them. So, like, they clearly respect the history, but it's just, that's also the problem, is that even when you respect the history, that doesn't mean that you're not going to go a little crazy from time to time and mix some metal in it. And that's where it gets hard to actually trust the studios to be respectful. And I hope we can trust Disney.
Yeah. Well, in episode 4 of Connecting with Walt, titled The Master Plan, Craig and I talked about the Walt Disney's original plan for Epcot and what a visit to Epcot, the city as Walt envisioned, it might have been like. So starting with this episode, Craig and I are going to begin a series on Epcot's future world. And during the course of this series, we'll examine, you know, its transition, how, you know, future world, you know, it's how the original concepts from the City of the Future moved into a theme park. You know, we looked at, we're going to look at all the pavilions within Future World. But if you haven't listened to episode 4, I highly recommend you listen to it to learn about Walt's original plans for Epcot. Now, in episode 75, A Dream Reimagined, we talked about how the concept of Epcot changed from a city of the future to the theme park, which became known as Epcot Center. And in episodes 86, 97, and 98, we talked about the history of Spaceship Earth, the icon of Epcot Center. So as I said, in today's episode, we're going to begin our exploration of Future World, beginning with the Universe of Energies Pavilion. And as we discussed in our previous episodes, the plans for Epcot Center and Future World changed over time. In the 1977 annual report for the Walt Disney Company, shareholders were treated to the details of the new theme park, along with some stunning concept art and photos of models of what was to come. Future World was described as the Future World, an American enterprise forum. It poses the challenges and previews alternatives for the community of the future. The report went on to say the principal components of Future World include a major introductory theme show, Spaceship Earth, the Communicore, a global marketplace of new ideas bringing the public into direct interface with industry, and a series of major pavilions exploring energy, life and health, the sea, the land, transportation, and space. In 1978, Card Walker, who's the president of the Walt Disney Company, re-announced the company's commitment to the Epcot Center project, and he unveiled a model that very closely resembles the Epcot we know today. The pavilions of Future World, as they were planned at that time and we previously described, are all there, with some in different locations than they are today. Spaceship Earth isn't yet a full geosphere in this, and the Communicore buildings were huge V-shaped space frames. Universe of Energy was the first pavilion to reach its final design, but there was no fountain in front of the building. Instead, Future World East was to have large, shallow lagoons, much like Future World West. These would be removed from the final design, and Future World East would become the dry side of the park.
Do you know mm-hmm. any reason why they made this change?
No, I don't. Yeah. Not at all.
Because it's one of the things that has always struck me is not odd, but and not off-putting, but there is a sort of better atmosphere on the other side of Epcot, I think a lot because of the water features mm-hmm. and stuff. It has less of that concrete jungle feel to it. And
that's exactly what I was thinking. It's more lush on the other side. It seems like there's more plantings over in Future World West even than there are in Future World yeah. East.
But granted, I mean, technically the other side is, you know, it is a lot more nature-based and more down-to-earth-based, especially with, you know, once mm-hmm. the seas came along and in the land pavilion. And, you know, even with Imagination, I feel like Imagination still reacts well with that certain landscape and features, whereas this other side of Epcot definitely does have a more industrial feel to it. So I guess thematically it kind of works, but at the same time, if they could have really just matched both sides of that park with that same atmosphere, I, you know, I don't, I just, even though it might all be changing because of the changes coming to Epcot, I think for years it could have just been a much more lush and beautiful area. Mm-hmm.
It would have been very well balanced. Yeah, I always disliked how the future, you know, future concepts were always so industrial, mm-hmm. you know, and stark and white, you know, things, and so that's why I guess Tony Baxter tried to redo that in the Tomorrowland that he reimagined for Disneyland that didn't quite work. But, yeah, I agree. That I've never cared for Future World East quite as much, even though it had some great pavilions when it opened.
Yeah, and, so. You know, if you really do care about the environment and such, and, you know, then it's actually, oddly enough, we know that the future is green and protecting the world that we do have. So it's kind of funny that that is the future and not this starkness of what you would see in the Jetsons and other futuristic endeavors.
Oh, I agree. Well, even in some, you know, since like in Star Trek and Star Wars, when they depict cities, so many of them are just buildings. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. clusters of these megatropolises with lots of ships or transportation. And I always think, wow, don't these people have parks or anything like that? Anyway. Well, anyway, so clockwise from Energy, there was Imagineers Tony Baxter's first version of the land, the Ecology Pavilion. And that was later dropped when Kraft Foods signed on as sponsor and demanded a more farming-focused attraction. Next comes the Transportation Pavilion, which would soon get rounded out and become the World of Motion. In the area between Future World and World Showcase is the American Adventure in this era, and its elevated modern structure. Now, sitting where Journey into Imagination would later be constructed is an early version of the Life and Health Pavilion, and where the land would later be built is an early and more elaborate Seas Pavilion. And then finally came the Space Pavilion.
Well, I think they nailed the placement of the pavilions better versus this version. I feel like there's a little bit more of a flow with what actually happened versus what could have happened.
Yeah, there was more of a theme when they finally settled in the next iteration of this.
Yeah. Good for Imagineering.
Now, an Energy Pavilion was one of the concepts that was agreed upon early in Epcot Center's development. Now, at first, Imagineers wanted to have the pavilion focus on solar energy and planned for a large solar energy collector to be located in the building's center. And then around the center would be a complex attraction featuring both unguided cars and a walkthrough portion. Eventually, they decided this design was too complicated and the concept was dropped. But when Exxon signed on to be the pavilion's sponsor, the Energy Pavilion scope was broadened to include all forms of energy, with a special focus on fossil fuels. Now, taking inspiration from the 1964 World's Fair, the new plans for the Energy Pavilion called for a large moving theater vehicles. By 1978, the plans also called for guests to travel back in time to view the dinosaurs and then learn about the power of energy, that wind, lightning, water, heat, and sun could create. By 1978, the design of the Energy Pavilion show building was in its final stages. Since a major part of the attraction story would be the photovoltaic cells, I hope I said that right, on the roof. It's a hard word to say late at night. Anyway, it would be these cells on the roof in the form of 2,156 solar panels, and that would help power the pavilion. Now, in particular, it would power the theater vehicles, and careful study was done in terms of the shape of the building as well as its location in the park to best collect sunlight.
I wonder how much it helped over the years.
So, well, the original, well, for a while they had the Energy Pavilion on the opposite side where they originally had thought the Space Pavilion would be. Mm-hmm. But that was really early until they realized there wouldn't be enough sun over there. Yeah. So,
yeah, well, that also, you know, that could, even though the trees never really got that high, that also makes more sense with kind of the area that it was situated in. I mean, there was not a lot going on that could block that building at all from shade, unless I guess the sun was ever at any point directly blocked by spaceship Earth. Other than that, it's, you know, if the sun's up, it's getting hit.
Yeah. Yeah, and Imagineers tracked the sun as it moved over the property and determined that the 105,000 square foot structure should be anchored facing southward and tilted 30 degrees from the horizon. So starting at roughly 20 feet above the entrance to the pavilion, the roof slopes upward to a height of nearly 60 feet at the rear. So it really was an impressive building when it was constructed.
But feat of engineering.
Yeah, absolutely. Across its width sat the array of these photovoltaic cells, and at the time of its construction, it was the largest privately funded solar power installation in the world. Each of the 4-inch round silicon solar cells captured photon energy from sunlight and converted it to approximately 1 watt of electrical energy. 36 individual cells were wired in series and housed in an aluminum-framed module. Almost 2,200 modules made up the photovoltaic array and together generated approximately 70,000 watts of direct current power. And the power was fed through an inverter that converted it to an alternating current to the utility power grid and supplied enough power nearly equal to that used in the RIDE system, or approximately 15 to 20% of the total energy used by the pavilion.
And that's impressive. I mean, yeah, it was a slow moving RIDE system, but those theater vehicles, you know, like you had seen used in other places as well, too, they were not small by any means.
And
once you add in, if back in the day when it first opened, I'm sure every single show was probably filled to capacity for a while. And when you start talking about the amount of weight that those have to carry and the extra oomph that they need to get moving on those tracks and stuff, that's a great deal of energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, you're right. Yeah, and we'll get into those theater ride vehicles. And when you think of the weight of them, it's extraordinary. That they were able to collect enough sun to move those things. Yeah. By 1979, the pavilion show building's design was finalized. During the Energy Pavilion's development, there were only minor changes to the building's exterior. A 1981 model of the pavilion shows that at one time, Imagineers planned on giving the pavilion a blue color scheme. Instead, the exterior was painted in transitioning sections of deep red to orange to yellow, suggesting radiating energy. The facade was embellished with 180,000 square mirrors. The lagoons depicted in the concept art were replaced by a fountain outside the pavilion with blue tiles, similar in size to the mirrors on the facade. The small reflecting pools at the corner of the pavilion complemented the fountain, but were later replaced with planters. When the pavilion was reimagined in 1996, the red-to-yellow palette was repainted a deep blue with rainbow pastel highlights. Dinosaur topiaries were shipped to Epcot Center from New York's Rockefeller Center, where they had been a part of a flower and garden festival and installed outside the entrance in 1996. But the Brontosaurus topiary kept suffering damage from guests hanging from its neck, and ultimately all the topiaries were removed in 2009. Perhaps as a trade-off, the pavilion's original color scheme was returned in 2009. I like when you hear how much thought went into the facade
yeah.
and the color and all of that, and how, you know, it was subtle, but even the facade colors were meant to communicate a story.
Yeah, and I don't think that ever really dawned on me until until you just pointed it out there. It just, you know, it's something I obviously noticed. I think everyone noticed it, but not something that people thought about. And the big one that I do not remember the topiary out there. And I should have a very distinct memory. You know, that is still in the heyday. It wasn't once I moved down to Florida, but still in the heyday of when I was coming and visiting very, very often. So the fact that I just don't even remember it is, it's making me feel old. I'll tell you that much.
Well, at one point they did reroute the path to avoid the topiary so that people would stop hanging from the neck of the Brontosaurus, but that still didn't work. Even like the reflecting pool with the tiles in it, again, that it reflected off the facade, and so that the ripples in the pool and the fountain was to suggest rippling energy.
Yeah.
So it really was amazing. Yeah. Just what went on the outside of the building, much less what we're going to talk about, what was going on the inside of the building.
I truly love that facade. That was one of the, when it closed down and such, and I went to document it, of course, I took as much time and effort as I could put into documenting the ride portion itself. But I can't tell you how many videos I have sitting on my hard drives right now of just exterior shots of the building from sides, just trying to capture the feeling of what it was like to be standing out in front of it. And even then, it's just one of those things that unfortunately video can never really capture, that true feeling of being there in front of it. And there's a lot of portions where you can get very close, but something about that pavilion, about the aesthetic to it, about the entire layout, it was done right. And
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, I also liked how you had to take a winding path up to it, that it was a journey, sort of to get there.
Exactly.
A unique ride vehicle that we had talked about was created, called Traveling Theater Cars. And the ride vehicles were 29 feet long by 18 feet wide. And fully loaded, they weighed just a little more than 30,000 pounds.
Holy cow.
I know. That's when you think of that they have the energy to power these things is amazing. Yeah. You know, just from the cells on the roof. Each vehicle was designed to hold approximately 97 guests and had the capability of accommodating 2 guests in wheelchairs. There were 6 individual cars providing the ability to handle up to 600 guests per show, but 13 cars, which gave it 2 six-pack formations and 1 spare, were constructed. Each vehicle was driven by a single 6-horsepower electric motor powered by 8 12-volt lead-acid automotive batteries. These batteries recharged during the show whilst the theater cars were in their stationary formation on the huge turntables. There were no mechanical connections for this recharging. The energy radiated through an airspace between the cars and a specially designed inductive power coupling in the turntable floor. So powerful electromagnets in the charging plates interacted with magnetic coils on the underside of each vehicle. And these charging plates were partially powered by the solar cells on the roof. And Disney advertised that guests were riding on sunshine, although only between 15 and 20% of the power came from the cells, like we said before. So pretty impressive.
Oh, no, that's incredibly impressive. It's just, that really is beyond. I mean, they decide to come out with technology like that today, you know, people are going to still be blown away and say, oh, that's incredible. Look at the leaps and bounds that they've moved forward to be able to do that and come up with such a efficient ride vehicle. And then when you pull back the curtain, be like, well, actually, this was made in the late 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, that's just next level awesome then. So it's what a time.
Yeah, really. Now, the coupling was designed by a subcontractor of Wet Enterprises, now known as, Wet Imagineering, Walt Disney Imagineering, and was silently and relatively maintenance-free. It was so safe that somebody could actually stand on it during operations and not be injured. The cars were guided by a wire embedded in the concrete floor. The wire was 1/8 inch thick and emitted a low-level radio frequency. And the vehicle was in constant communication with a computer that issued the speed, start, stop, and turn commands for the vehicle through the wire. As a safety measure, there were benchmarks on the floor, and as the vehicle passed over the benchmark, a signal was sent to the computer, which was constantly updating and compared the theater car's actual location with where the computer knew it should be at the time. So this updating happened every 20 milliseconds. If a car failed to cross the proper benchmark at the proper time, the system was designed to automatically shut off. Again, remarkable. Again, yeah. Considering this is the late 70s.
Exactly. I can't say much more than that. It's just like the vehicles themselves, yeah. The entire way that they ran. It was ahead of its time. And that, to think that, like, today, the big rage with Disney attractions is trackless ride vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so it's just so, so ahead of its time with all this. Yeah. Just amazing.
Yeah. Absolutely. The Sinclair Oil Corporation started in 1916, and its famous logo was a green dinosaur silhouette that was reminiscent of a brontosaurus, which helped popularize the correlation between the formation of petroleum deposits and dinosaurs. And, of course, on the television show Dinosaurs, the family was called the Sinclairs.
Exactly.
So, yeah. It is now agreed that more than 90% of oil came from trees and vegetation, although much of it is from the era of the dinosaurs. Now, in Walt Disney's 1940 film Fantasia, the Rite of Spring sequence included a climactic battle scene between a Stegosaurus and a Tyrannosaurus Rex that, all of us that are into dinosaurs know never could have happened since those creatures lived in different eras. But it was highly memorable and dramatic. So 46 audio animatronic dinosaurs that Walt Disney's and his Imagineers had created for the Ford Motor Company's 1964-65 World's Fair Pavilion were relocated to Disneyland and installed as a glimpse into what a primeval world in the Grand Canyon might have looked like millions of years ago. And the new edition debuted on July in 1966 as the grand finale of the Santa Fe and Disneyland Railroad. Once again, the climax was the battle between the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the Stegosaurus as volcanoes erupted and lava, oozes around them.
Yeah.
The universe of energy.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say it's another aspect of that entire scene is, it's just that. I'll let you go on. Sorry.
But I love the enhancements that they put in recently.
Yeah.
Really nice job.
Yeah. The last time it went through its refurbishment on that, it's another one where you look at it and like, how old is it? This is just incredible looking.
They gave it new life, yeah. Completely new life.
Yep.
So. The Universe of Energy offered a similar but more elaborate experience. The attraction presented a 7-minute journey through a scenic backdrop diorama surrounding a primeval forest. The diorama stretched 32 feet high and 515 feet across and took 3 artists nearly 6,000 hours to paint. Since no photos or drawings exist from the prehistoric era, the Imagineers consulted well-known paleontologists and paleobotanists to learn as much as they could about the plants and animals of millions of years ago. Hundreds of books, publications, museum plates, exhibits, and fossils were reviewed. The Imagineers even used research to try to approximate the actual sounds prehistoric creatures might have made. However, this attraction was not meant to be a museum. So some things were exaggerated and sometimes recreated larger than they may have been for dramatic effect. Again, the research that they put into this, and that we're not even aware of it as we go through.
Exactly.
As we went through this, how much research went into this to try to make it as factual as they could with the knowledge at the time.
And the fact is, it's so dark. It was so dark in those rooms that they didn't need to go to that effort, but they still did. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot right there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, the 36 dinosaurs were the largest audio animatronic animals ever to be constructed by WED. They were so huge that some of the dinosaurs had to be placed in the pavilion building first, and then the roof was installed. Another challenge was the construction of the prehistoric trees. The forest is landscaped 250 prehistoric trees that rise up to 40 feet overhead. A lightweight foamed plastic similar to the cellulose structure of the plant's woody pulp was used to capture the tensile and compressive characteristics of a real tree that would sway with the breeze. The plastics used to make the trees are made from the fossil fuels created by the real prehistoric trees. And they had huge, huge fans in the room that created the breeze so that the trees would sway.
Yeah, yeah. There's a small little detail that means a lot.
Yeah, and you know, we might not consciously notice these details, but subconsciously we do.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it more real to us.
I mean, it's Disney. It's when it's not, when you are going through and you notice something like, no, that's not swaying with the wind, that's when you notice it. You just don't notice it when it is happening. And that's
exactly
one of the wild parts of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny how our brains work, too. So, the warm room was filled with fog, along with swampy smells made by WED smellitzers. The first creatures you saw included a giant millipede and, all right, now we're going to go through some of these dinosaur names. Edaphosaurus. The biggest dinosaurs in the swamp are a herd of brontosauruses lazily munching water plants. Duck-billed trachodons were seen bathing in a pool of water. A number of ornithomimus, whatever, watch helpless as one of their own sinks into a boiling tar pit. Numerous pterodons perched menacingly on cliffs and rocks. On an overhead cliff, a stegosaurus fights another dinosaur that was designed to be more historically accurate, an Allosaurus. On September 15th, 1996, the Universe of Energy reopened as Ellen's Energy Adventure, since more recent research indicated the dinosaurs were more like birds than lizards. The audio animatronic creatures were given new skins and repainted brighter with more stripes and other markings in fluorescent shades of orange and blue, and the dinosaur effects were redone as well. A water misting effect of the overhanging brontosaurus sneezing was added because a similar gag with an oversized dog had proven to be popular in the Honey, I Shrunk the Audience attraction that opened in 1994. The ornithomimus in the pool was also given a water effect to spit at guests in the vehicles. The flora was rehabbed as well, with new foliage added throughout the diorama to make it look greener, lusher, and less rocky, and the smellitzers were deactivated during the renovation. The Elasmosaurus and the Ellen audio animatronic figures, along with the accompanying audio track, were removed in 2014 and never replaced. In an interview with Disney historian and friend of the show, Jim Corcus, Marty Sklar said, "It dawned on us that there hadn't been a new song written for the park since 1969, not since Exotencio wrote Grim Grinning Ghosts for the Haunted Mansion and Yo-Ho-Ho for the Pirates of the Caribbean. 13 years and no new songs, and that needed to be rectified. So we immediately called the Shermans, who are the legendary songwriters Dick and Bob Sherman, and told them to start writing songs for Epcot. They wrote some great stuff, but with so many pavilions, they couldn't write everything. We brought in a young California songwriter named Bob Molin, or Moline, and took a chance," Sklar said. "He had made an impression when he had performed for a group of Disneyland executives during a private function. We had him write a jingle for Disneyland. It could only happen at Disneyland, and the advertisement won a Clio Award. He was performing at a bar in Newport Beach. His contribution to the sound of Epcot is often forgotten," Sklar said. "He wrote or co-wrote songs like Listen to the Land for the Land Pavilion, Canada, You're a Lifetime Journey for the Canada Pavilion, Golden Dreams for the American Pavilion with Randy Bright, and of course, Energy You Make the World Go Round for the Universe of Energy that played during the pre-show and was sung by John Joyce. Academy Award-winning songwriters Al Kasha and Joel Hirshhorn wrote the theme song Universe of Energy that was at the end of the attraction."
It's kind of surprising that Marty Sklar said that, you know, his contribution to Epcot is forgotten. I think that's almost kind of poor words in a sense, that maybe, yeah, people not knowing that it was his contribution, but I don't know anyone who is a fan of classic Epcot and does not know everything about all of those songs. The fact, you know, even going on that they still exist in some iteration and mm-hmm. you hear them on all the releases. Like I can't tell you how many times I listened to all those songs when we made a trip down to Florida and stopped at a Disney store that happened to be selling, it was the 1991 official album of Disneyland and Walt Disney World, and got that on cassette. And, you know, I loved the front side with Disneyland songs and Magic Kingdom songs, but I was all about the Epcot songs on the other side mm-hmm. of the cassette. And so, yeah, his contribution itself and what he did might have been unknown or forgotten, but the fans still to this day know them, and you know, some of them have a presence in Epcot forever, even though that will be going away soon as of recording this episode. Yeah. So the Epcot,
that's true,
temporarily,
but
forever.
And when you hear the titles, you know, like Listen to the Land, you know, you immediately start thinking of the song, mm-hmm. or at least I do, or Golden Dreams, or even like Energy You Make the World Go Round.
And
all that. But and the same thing, it's just like when I think of It's a Small World, immediately the tune starts playing in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so so these are wonderful songs, and you still hear them in background music at Epcot and all that, so I'm glad that they're still keeping them.
Yeah.
You know, so that, but you know, a lot of younger folks might not realize that they're listening to, but at least they're alive in some fashion.
Yeah.
When the attraction was reimagined and became Ellen's Energy Adventure in 1996, at the end, announcer Johnny Gilbert in the Jeopardy show tells the audience, "Some contestants on Jeopardy will receive a year's supply of energy. Energy, You Make the World Go Round." And this was as a homage to the attraction's original song. Bruce Broughton wrote the score for Ellen's Energy Adventure. Construction began on the Energy Pavilion, eventually named the Universe of Energy, in late 1979. The pavilion featured 105,000 feet of show area and 2,156 solar panels. It was completed on time and opened with the rest of Epcot Center on October 1st, 1982. A Disney press release from October 1982 stated, "The Universe of Energy experience begins with our first glimpse of the building's exterior. Its dynamic shape is itself an expression of energy. A wedge-shaped structure with the apex of its enormous triangle tilted toward the ground, it appears to be simultaneously rising out of the earth and driving into it. Warm bands of color, symbolic of radiating heat, alternate along its sides. As we approach, we notice that this slanting roof glistens with a blanket of solar panels. The mammoth array of photovoltaic cells faces the sun, drawing in its energy and converting it into electric current. This combination of the functional and the aesthetic is a subliminal statement of the pavilion's overall theme, that by exploring and developing alternative energy sources, we can build an energy bridge to a better tomorrow. As we near the apex, we notice a separate structure standing in front of the main building. Its mirrored surface reflects the images of rippling water from a pool below. The reflection seems to suggest energy in motion. And beyond the reflecting pool is the main entrance. And in our next episode, you can join us and take a ride on the original universe of energy and the version that came after it. But now it's time for us to take a ride back to find out what happened this week in Disney history. Well, Craig, as I went through what happened this week in Disney history, again, a lot of it was what was nominated for Oscars and who said, I'm going to Disneyland after they won the Super Bowl. So I've avoided all of those.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Anyway. All right. I guess the Super Bowl used to happen a lot earlier, or at least a week or two earlier.
I feel like even when I was growing up that it happened a little bit sooner. But yeah. I'm just so upset that this episode that I don't have another person to play against, because it was really refreshing getting to play against Tony in the last episode. I forgot how much easier it was with the multiple choice and stuff. But so a lot of extra work for you coming up with extra answers.
yeah. And then when I go back and listen to it, because I listened to it and I was driving to Walt Disney Family Museum, I thought, oh, there was one part where I forgot to let you steal for a point. But you were already clearly ahead.
Yeah, I didn't. I remember the exact moment, and I was going to say something, but I'm like, nah, it's working in my favor anyways.
Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah, so I was out of practice for that. But hopefully we'll have someone else. I'm working on having someone else on for an episode, and maybe they will join you in this fun little competition.
I hope so.
All right. All righty. Well, we're going to start out this week with January 26th. On January 26th, 1972, the first episode of a new Disney television series created by Ward Kimball aired its first episode. What is the name of this syndicated series?
I am not quite sure.
This was called The Mouse Factory. And it was hosted by a different celebrity guest each week. The Mouse Factory features clips from various Disney cartoons and films. The first episode, Vacation, is hosted by Charles Nelson Reilly. Those of you who are fans of the classic Match game show will know him well, who discusses disastrous vacations with Donald Duck. And some of these episodes are on YouTube, and I love this show. It was Ward Kimball through and through. It was not highly regarded by those who worked at Walt Disney Studios. They didn't like the irreverence of it. They did not like how he used clips out of context and reuse them. And I would love for this to air on, you know, Disney Plus. First of all, they would have to get so many estates to, you know, permission from a lot of estates like Phyllis Diller and Snow White and, you know, and Charles Nelson Reilly and all kinds of people. But I thought it was amusing. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Do you know if that first episode is on? Because I love Charles Nelson Reilly.
I did too. It is. It is on there. Sometimes, though, the opening isn't on there on some of the episodes that are on YouTube. And the opening was hilarious. It was sort of in the vein of almost like if folks – I'm really – people who are my age will remember a series hosted by Hans Conried called Fractured Flickers, which is great. And then or very much like the Monty Python style of openings, where it's just all these clips. It's boom, 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 one after the other. Yeah. Very energetic. So anyway, all right. January 27th. Herman Samuel Kamen was born on January 27th, 1892 in Baltimore, Maryland, and he would grow up to orchestrate the growth of Disney merchandise from 1932 to 1949. He is better known by what name?
And that would be Kay Kamen.
That's correct. Yep, and Kay Kamen was a stickler for quality. He set an unprecedented standard in licensing Disney character merchandise, including books, music, and plush toys. And he subsequently helped transform Mickey Mouse and other Disney characters into megastars. With an office at Rockefeller Center in New York City, Kamen devised and instituted marketing campaigns, which ensured Disney toys were featured dominantly on the shelves of the nation's leading retail outlets. And if you go to visit the Walt Disney Family Museum, there is a whole wall of much of the merchandise that he helped bring to stores. And at the Mickey Mouse From Walt to the World exhibit, there's even more, including one of the department store displays that was in London. That how this survived, I'll never know. And it's enormous. I had no idea when I did the show on Kay Kamen. I think it was for our Legacy Disneyland series. Mm-hmm. This thing is huge. and it was mechanical. And it's very impressive. So if you do have a chance to get to the Walt Disney Museum, be sure you check all that out. Okay. All right, for January 28th, actor and voice actor Hal Smith passes away at age 77 on January 28th, 1994, in Santa Monica, California. Best known for his comedic role of Otis Campbell on CBS's The Andy Griffith Show, Smith voiced several Disney characters. Craig, how many of the Disney characters can you name?
It's
astonishing how many characters in this man's life he voiced. I think it was almost 130, not all for Disney.
Well, and that's where I feel very embarrassed, because I don't even recognize his name.
Well, he was the town drunkard on the Andy Griffith Show. That, and this is what blows me away when you hear, I mean, look him up. And I guarantee you, he voiced some of your favorite characters.
Yeah, I never really watched the Andy Griffith Show. My dad always loved it, so I think
I love the Andy Griffith Show.
It was one of those ones where I think I kind of never really got into it, because it was one of those things like, oh, he's watching Andy Griffith again, and then, you know, Matlock would come on, and it's like, this guy again?
Well, he voiced Owl in the first four original Winnie the Pooh Disney shorts. He voiced the Disney cartoon character Goofy after Pinto Colvig died in 1967. In 1981, Smith reprised his role as Owl and voiced Winnie the Pooh in the short Winnie the Pooh Discovers the Seasons and the Disney Channel series Welcome to Pooh Corner. He replaced Sterling Holloway as the original voice of Pooh. Smith's voice credits also include Gyro Gearloose and Flintheart Glomgold in DuckTales, The Auctioneer and the Small One. He was Philippe the Horse in Beauty and the Beast, and like I told you, like 120-something more characters. I mean, even when he was on the Andy Griffith Show, he was voicing – he was in every major Saturday morning cartoon at the time.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. I feel dumb now.
He's incredible. I loved the cartoon series Top Cat growing up. That was in my he voiced like two or three characters in that series. I had no idea. So a very impressive man. So
I'll try to store that in my brain for next time.
Yeah. Okay, January 29th. Walt Disney's third feature film, Fantasia, had its Hollywood premiere on January 29th, 1941. Which theater hosted the premiere?
I believe they... I believe it went back to Carthay.
You're correct. It was the Carthay Circle Theater. I wish I could have seen this theater.
I know.
The film had debuted at the Broadway Theater in New York City on November 13th, 1940. The audience at the Carthay Circle were even more enthusiastic than the ones in New York. So, and a funny thing about this, I told you last week off air, you know, how I... you know, Tom Sito spoke at the Walt Disney Family Museum, and he was telling all these stories. Oh no, no, it was the week before that, and anyway, and I was hearing some of the 17 hours of recordings that Walt did, where he was talking about his life that he did for Diane, and then in the Peter Martin interviews, and those are from 1956, and it was during the Peter Martin interview in his office, Walt's office, that a note got handed to Walt, and he was going through some of his stuff on his desk and all that, and Walt said, "Okay, sorry, but I'm quoting Walt, so I am using an expletive here." Walt says, "Son of a bitch, Fantasia's in the black." That's how long it took that film to make money.
and it's lucky it ever got in the black. I mean, that's you'll read articles even to this very day about movies. The big one that gets brought up a lot is Men in Black. One of the producers, or I can't remember who it was, like, constantly will post about it that according to the companies that made it, Sony Columbia, it still is not made a profit to this very day. Yeah. And that was released in the 90s, and we're now in the 20s. So it's very believable.
Yeah, but that was one of the gems Randy Thornton, Walt Disney Records, oh, shared.
Yeah. So that's great. That's a gem. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so January 30th, the television series Walt Disney Presents airs the Peter Tchaikovsky story on January 30th, 1959. It is one of the first stereophonic broadcasts of a television program. Now, Craig, how was this accomplished with the technology of 1959?
This is one of those feats. I actually am not aware of this one.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's very clever. In certain cities, the audio portion of the broadcast was transmitted by two radio stations, an AM station carrying one channel, whilst an FM outlet carried the other. And so you played both. You had two radios, and you played both in your home as you listened to the television with the sound turned down.
That seems...
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's very intricate. I mean, I can honestly say it's crazy as it sounds. I mean, it's something that people who love sports, I know it's a commonplace thing still to do. So, like... you know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and our one announcer that used to be on TV that's beloved, eventually he made the transition to only radio. So it wasn't uncommon to be like, okay, well, we're just not going to listen to the TV broadcast. We'll watch it, but we're going to play the radio to hear the play-by-play. So It's kind of funny that it's like it's kind of one of the bases of even doing that goes back to Disney.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and folks, if you're not familiar, Tchaikovsky was a 19th century Russian classical composer. His best-known works, probably The Nutcracker and the ballet version of Sleeping Beauty. And much of his music from that ballet was used by Walt Disney in the film Sleeping Beauty.
I'm not even going to lie. I didn't know Tchaikovsky's first name was Peter.
Oh, okay. There you go. We'll see.
Learning lots of new stuff.
You would have known watching this on January 30th, 1959.
they need to put it on Disney Plus now.
I know. I just wish they would put more of the Walt Disney series on the air.
I can only watch Disneyland Around the Seasons and the Plausible Impossible so many times.
I know. I know, and they've had more episodes on like the Disney Treasure series as part of the on as full blown. You know, that's what was featured, or as the added. You know, the bonuses. So at least put those on. You know, but I don't know. Anyway, maybe they will. Maybe, you know, they can't do everything at once because they have to, you know, have a reason for new people to come on and for the rest of us to stay with it. Anyway, for January 31st, once the hub of Epcot Center, it closed on January 31st, 1994. What was its name?
That should have been Communicore.
That's right. Communicore East and West. Yep, exactly. Communicore East and West, originally the hub of Epcot Center, both geographically and conceptually, it brought together nearly all of the ideas and concepts explored in Future World and complemented the experiences offered by the park's other pavilions. And we're going to talk about what the energy exchange that complemented the Universe of Energy Pavilion in next week's episode. Dedicated to technological advance, Communicore occupied two buildings behind Spaceship Earth. In an effort to keep Epcot updated and vital, Communicore will be replaced with Interventions, which will officially open to guests the following September. Okay, and finally, hard to believe, we're in February. February 1st, a future Imagineer and Disney legend was born in Los Angeles, California on February 1st, 1947. He was first hired at Disneyland in 1965 as an ice cream scooper on Main Street, USA when he was just 17 years old. What is his name?
I'm going to use the age as a tip-off, and for that, I'm going to say Tony Baxter.
You're right, Tony Wayne Baxter. And he went on to become Senior Vice President of Creative Development at Walt Disney Imagineering. His Disney park credits during his 47-year career include Big Thunder Mountain Railroad, the original Journey into Imagination Pavilion, Star Tours, Splash Mountain, Indiana Jones Adventure, the redesign of Disneyland's Fantasyland, the design of Disneyland Paris, and so much more.
Nothing people care about. Honestly,
just an amazing, amazing career. So, and he is hilarious to hear talk to. I love it. You would love his sense of humor. Oh my gosh, it's so dry and sarcastic.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to hear him speak three or four times.
Oh, okay, good.
Every time, it's just, it's an incredible pleasure. You are 100% correct. He and I are on the same wavelength when it comes to just dripping dry humor.
Yeah. Yeah. He's someone that I would love to just, you know, have him over just to sit and chat about whatever, because he's so sardonic. I love it. And entertaining and knowledgeable. I mean, it's just great. Mm-hmm. It just seems like he'd be a nice all around guy, you know, to hang out with, is the impression I get, with no pretension. So, anyway, but yeah, well, someday, you never know. So he also tells the story because, you know, he was young enough. He was actually hired by Carnation. That's the only way he could get a job at Disneyland so young. And so he said, you know, he'd get there early to help with getting the ice cream parlor ready. And he said, you know, so the Carnation, you know, the truck would come up to deliver milk and ice cream. And he said a lot of times it was Walt Disney driving the truck. Because Walt Disney, first of all, he enjoyed it. But Walt Disney wanted to get to know all aspects of the park, you know, from the ground up. So then he used those experiences to improve the park for the guests.
It's a way to do it.
Yeah, but I thought, how amazing, you're 17 years old and you're waiting for the milk and ice cream delivery and it's Walt Disney who's delivering it.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, yeah. Well, you did a nice job there. Not too bad.
That's tough going back to it on my own, but I could have done worse.
It is. Well, we'll see. Now we're going to get people writing in saying, well, we'll be on the show.
Yeah, it's if only we could schedule it.
I know that's the. I know you're a busy man. It's tough to have guests on to do just the history. All right. Well, next week we are going to continue our journey through the universe of energy, and I think you're those of you who never rode the original attraction, I think you're going to be just blown away by what we describe. So, but until then, many books, films, articles, interviews, and lectures were sourced for this episode of Connecting with Walt. The books that I referred to, the Epcot Explorer's Encyclopedia, A Guide to Walt Disney World's Greatest Theme Park by R.A. Peterson, and Walt Disney's Epcot Center, Creating the New World of Tomorrow, with text by Richard R. Beard. There are several websites I found helpful, including the Mickey Wiki, History of Disney Theme Parks in Documents. It's better known as DisneyDocs.net. This is a treasure trove of Disney history that I've gone to several times, and they're always adding to it. It's a lot of fun. Lost Epcot, Extinct Disney, Mouse Planet, and Progress City USA. And if you want to get ready for next week's episode, on YouTube, look up Universe of Energy, Martin's Complete Ultimate Tribute. They have done an extraordinary job of describing or showing the original Universe of Energy pavilion, including some really amazing graphics and diagrams of just how the whole pavilion operated, and then a really well done ride through of the original.
Yeah, I mean, Martin is his importance in documenting Disney is, you know, that's part of why I am so anal about it and what I do. I mean, it's because I grew up watching his videos that he's been putting out since, you know, it took hours to download them on dial-up internet. And he's just, you know, he's gone back and he's revised videos, made them better, updated them as he could. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where even if I put out a video on the exact same, you know, ride of, as it's going to close down, it's just he makes these videos into a whole different beast. So please go out and watch his videos. They're just phenomenal.
They are. They're very good. I mean, the next one I want to look at is his People Mover one tribute. So, anyway, all right. Well, Craig, until next time, where can our listeners find you on the Diz Unplugged network of shows?
You know, all the shows that you can find me on are still the same. But then, of course, if you want to connect with me a little bit deeper, you can always follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Teleclaster. What about you, Michael?
Well, you can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. Twitter, I'm at mbowling121. Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling, but the one with the Connecting with Walt banner is the one that you want to like so that you can stay up to date on whatever I'm doing in the Disney sphere. Instagram, it's Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with me and Craig on Twitter at Connecting Walt. If you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studios, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Legacy Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes at DisneyUnplugged.com, or just look at the link in the show notes Craig always thoughtfully provides. And look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. Thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.